All financial advice provided on this show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. The financial ideas and strategies discussed are only provided as a starting point for a conversation about money matters. With regard to your particular investments and financial strategies, consult your financial planner, CPA, or investment professional. All your financial decisions are yours and yours alone to make and subsequently are solely your responsibility. The information that is supplied through the context of the radio program and any repurposing of its content by the host or network is a combination and collection of solid financial investment understanding, opinion, and comments. This network, show, and its host are not liable for financial strategies, outcomes that you employ in any manner that result in any kind of loss. Shares of corporate sponsors may be the subject of buy or sell recommendations in Jay Taylor's newsletter in accordance with Jay's objective opinion.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. This hour will help investors fix issues and achieve personal gain. Now, here's your host, Jay Taylor.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I am your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm speaking to you from New York City on this, the 28th day of May, 2019. And always like to remind you that I'm the author of Jay Taylor's Gold, Energy, and Tech Stocks. Sign up for that by going to miningstocks.com. I'd like to encourage you to consider signing up for Chen's newsletter, What is Chen Buying, What is Chen Selling? Go to chenpicks.com for that. And also Michael Oliver, it's olivermsa.com. We'll be talking to Mike in just a few minutes from now. And I do want to thank all of you for listening to this show, and please send along your comments, questions, or whatever you have, thoughts you have about this show, send them along to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. Also want to thank our sponsors for making this show economically viable. For today's show, our sponsors are Klondike Gold, Novo Resources, RN Resources, and Strike Point Gold. Now, before we get started with today's show, I would like to advise you that there were that both Novo Resources and Klondike Gold, the two of the sponsors I just noted, released two very important news releases today. Novo Resources talked about its mineralization report from its Karratha project and how it is planning to proceed with its exploration program there over the next few months. And Dr. Quentin Henning will be with me during the second segment of today's show, and I'm sure he'll talk more about the press release today as well as the three projects that the company is working on in Australia. And Peter Talman's Klondike Gold announced today that it's beginning to drill at on the Klondike property. Now, this is particularly exciting to me because, as you heard last week, if you listened to Peter last week, Klondike now believes that they have discovered the structural controls where the high-grade gold exists, located in their 563 square kilometer property in the Yukon. And, you know, they've been finding a lot of lower grade disseminated gold mineralization, which is very important from a longer term perspective. But what really gets the stock investors excited in these junior gold stocks are some high grade hits. Peter said, and I quote, "Our press release is in time for your show today." He sent me this email and he said, "Our press release is in time for your show today. We have started drilling at Gay Gulch and El Dorado Fault." Now, you haven't heard much about El Dorado Fault, unlike the Parallel Nugget Fault and the Bonanza Fault where Lone Star is. Hopefully, with this drill program and some related surface investigations, we will start talking about it more. It won't take long to complete the short seven-hole program. Some of these holes can be drilled in a 12-hour shift. So I'm suggesting that any of you who own this stock might want to keep a close eye on what happens. We should start getting some drill results very soon, and I believe that they are targeting these high-grade intercepts where the management now believes they have figured out where the structural controls are. So that's very exciting. But speaking of high-grade results, now just hot off the press, Great Bear, who has been a sponsor of this show up until a week or so ago, he just came out with some really exciting news on its Red Lake property, specifically 12.33 grams of gold per ton over 14 meters, including 30.9 grams per ton over 4.6 meters, and 194.21 grams of gold over 2 meters. And that includes 759.38 grams of gold over a half a meter in multiple shallow gold zones at a brand new discovery that they just made at Great Bear. And I'm looking at the stock. It just started trading shortly before we went on the air, and it is up about, let's see, it's up 36 cents today. That's a 16% rise on the information. Very exciting news. So I expect, hopefully we'll have Chris Taylor on the show sometime in the near future, but these are really exciting numbers. It's a really exciting industry when you start hitting some good high-grade results. Anyway, today's show I've titled The Dollar is a U.S. Problem. Dan Oliver, Dr. Quentin Henning, and Michael Oliver return as guests. The dollar system was founded at Bretton Woods and rests on three pillars: American military supremacy, American financial hegemony, and American economic prowess. Russia and China are challenging America's military power, and a new Eastern trading bloc and the euro are challenging America's financial hegemony, and America's debt problem is challenging its economic prowess. So those are topics that I'll be talking to Dan Oliver about during the second half of today's show. And I want to ask Don to discuss each of these threats to the American prosperity and provide a prediction of what those threats might mean to the dollar hegemony and, by extension, of course, to the price of gold. And as I just noted, Dr. Henning will be with me in the second segment of today's show, Dr. Quentin Henning. He'll give us an update on what Novo is doing. Very exciting news. Now, not as exciting as when they first made those great discoveries, those gold nuggets, but the work is continuing, and I think longer term, this is still remains one of my top picks and one of my, I think, most exciting stories that we're covering among a growing list of exciting stories. But right now, we have Michael Oliver with us, and thank you for joining me again, Michael.
Hi, Jay. Good to be back.
Good to have you with us, as always, and it's good to tell our listeners it's olivermsa.com, olivermsa.com, to learn more about Michael's work, and specifically, if you're interested in the precious metals, he has a lower-priced, very useful service that keeps you abreast of the precious metals. Michael, you have been saying and have been saying for some time that you think that we need to see the equity markets get weaker before we're going to see any kind of meaningful rise in the price of gold. Could you explain? I mean, that hasn't always been true. Sometimes they run in unison, but right now you're suggesting that they're going in opposite directions generally. They're not linked in positive correlation any longer.
I think that's the case. I think the divorce occurred in 2011, and it was prior to that they were in sync. Gold was on the upside, would lead the S&P in terms of percent gains during those years from 2000 to 2011. But the basic large surges and drops were fairly coincident. Gold, for example, collapsed into late 2008, where the S&P peaked in late 2007, but started its collapse in the latter part, summer and fall of 2008. Gold joined in at that point, and it collapsed as well. They both turned in early 2009 from their lows. And gold went from, it was $680 and went to 1920 between that 2009 low and late 2011. During that same time, the S&P advanced, but nowhere near as much. But they were in sync. But then in late 2011, the S&P was making a sell-off low after the European debt crisis. Remember, in the summer of 2011, you had a big hit in the S&P and the German index and so forth. And it made a low, and the central banks went crazy at that point in terms of policy, and that drove the developed market indices up big time. At that point, gold divorced and went down. It topped in 11, collapsed in late 2012, early 2013. At that point, it's totally opposite now. So the people who are still focused on issues like, well, if the S&P collapses, won't gold collapse? Yeah, that was true in 2008. But since then, their major moves have been opposite. In fact, if you just go back over the last year or so, even some of the moderate and minor moves in terms of peaks and troughs are inverse. Some of them pretty good inverse, some of them almost precisely. Just a recent example, for example, we had the run-up in gold 2 weeks ago, and it spiked up over 1,300. Mm-hmm. May 13th, Monday morning. That was the same time the S&P made its low for this move at 2801, almost within hours, inverse. And the S&P since then bounced sharply, rallied about 3% after that 2801 low over the next week or so. And gold did what? Backed off about 3% from the 1302 high close that it had in May 13th. And since then, gold's gone into congestion zone between the highs and lows. And what's the S&P done? Gone into congestion between that high and the lows. So we're getting very similar action in this case, even pinned down to the day. So I think the people who are worried about a major stock market drop, which we think is going to happen, it will be the opposite this time. I think you're bringing investors into gold, and you can see it when the S&P gets whacked, not necessarily to the hour like it was Monday a few weeks ago, but the inverse relationship is good. Now, also look back, for example, S&P made its second of its three peaks back in August, September of last year, prior to that late 2018 collapse. You went from a high at 2940 all the way down to 2350 in the latter part of the year. But as the S&P was making that marginal new high above the January 2018 high, doing it in August, September of 2018, what was gold doing? Making a low around 1160. What happened between then? Gold ground its way up and then finally shot up with real strength late in 2018. December was quite a month. What happened to the S&P? It arm wrestled its way down and then collapsed into December 2018. Now, what's really interesting, though, is this, not just the inverse relationship, but lately, and I think this is evidence of investor shift, regardless of S&P's rally. It doesn't impress them. For example, why is not gold back down near the August 2018 low at 1160?
Yeah.
After all, S&P went up and marginally nipped out the high of that time period. So if gold were equally as weak as the S&P was strong, it would be back down there. So instead, since that August low of last year in gold, gold went from about 39.8% of the price level of the S&P. It's now over 45% of the price level of the S&P. So despite all the noise and the opposite zigzags, gold has gained ground relative to the S&P since that low, despite the fact that S&P went to a new high. It still offset that.
Yeah.
So it shows that even though the S&P went up again to a marginal new high, we should fail that, the money did not flee gold market. Some of it backed out, but you only hit a moderate pullback. So that indicates to me some resolute nature of investor buying in gold. The hand is firmer than it was back in August of last year.
Sure, sure.
So
well, Michael,
going forward, in other words, go ahead.
No, you go ahead. Go ahead.
No, but going forward, I think gold investors need to be aware of that fact that we are in the divorce situation versus the developed market stock indices, and not to fear the issue of a repetition of the late 2008 collapse in the stock market in which gold participated. I think it's exact opposite now. If anything, an S&P collapse will further encourage investors moving across the line and to the gold market.
Right. Well, Michael, what about the Treasury? You know, who obviously most of the money flows into the Treasuries when it comes out of the equities, right? So it's risk off. It goes to Treasuries. Maybe a bit of it goes to gold, as you're suggesting. But, you know, what do you see going forward? Do you still see that for the Treasuries? Do you see Treasury rates coming down a lot?
Obviously, they'll benefit. And right now, they're quite strong, by the way. They're making new highs for this recent move.
Yes.
So the Treasuries sent something fairly immediate on the horizon, I think. And I don't think it's some long-term interest rate situation here when you're dealing with the 30-year and the 10-year. I think the move there is, in fact, a flight to safety. And therefore, the question is, why is the money flowing so resolutely and suddenly now into the Treasury market over the last few weeks while the S&P is congested after its recent drop? I think the T-bond sense that recent congestion in the S&P is not going to prevail. And that you know, a few weeks from now, the S&P might not be anywhere around where it is right now.
Right. So that should provide some wind at the back of the gold investors and gold share people as well, I would think, and probably the Treasury markets. But how much lower can these rates go, for goodness sakes?
No, I think that, you know, it could be a spike in the T-bonds if the S&P breaks. And, you know, speed is the issue. It's not a slow S&P decline, but a rapid one is what engenders that, you know, flight to quality stuff. I do suspect, and this is I don't want to emphasize it too much, I think if the S&P does snap rapidly sometime in the next few weeks, and we have a suspicion that could happen, that the move in gold will also be rapid. So it'll be opposite, but also of the same tenor and tone, but reversed, of the S&P, as there are very few places on the planet to put money. Developed market stock indices are not working well. Japan, Europe, our market's working better than theirs, so we've attracted a lot of foreign capital into the U.S. stock market. But it's a loaded boat right now, the U.S. stock market. It's loaded with foreign capital, and I think once that money starts to flow out, it's also going to whack the dollar. The dollar is somewhat in sync with the S&P now, by the way, in our view. And also the dollar is an issue that a lot of gold people look at and say, well, gee, the dollar's so strong, how can gold be up? Well, that's a good question, isn't it?
Yeah.
The dollar has, since last August, if you use the dollar as your reference point, whether to buy or not buy gold, you wouldn't have bought gold because the dollar's right. remained steady to firm. It's gained, well, 1% since August 2018 high. It was a rally high in the dollar when gold was making its low. But the dollar held in there, whereas gold rallied 10% with no help from a weak dollar.
Yeah.
In fact, right now the dollar is 1% higher than it was 10 months ago, which is trivial, but it's still higher. And yet gold is now, you know, not 1160 something, it's 1280, you know.
Yes.
So,
so things are looking up. Things are looking up for
the
gold bugs.
Huh?
Things are looking, we've had a lot of people very concerned because gold's going nowhere, Michael, but it seems to me that the sun is about to shine on the gold markets and people shouldn't be in despair.
No, I fully agree, and I also think that if it's going through the mid-1300s, which we think so, and that's a very clear level for the price folks, they'll get excited when you do that. I think it'll be suddenly. I don't think it'll be an erosional rally. I think it'll be a thunderbolt, and it probably might be reflective of the opposite for the S&P.
All right, we're going to have to leave it go at that, Michael. We're out of time. Thank you for that great overview of these, you know, the relationship between these markets. It's always important to understand. To understand them. Thank you so much. Well, folks, we do have to go to break, but I'd like to tell you that I see Great Bear is up now 41 cents in Canadian money. It's up almost 19% today on that great drilling news. It is an exciting time, and we're going to go to break, and when we come back, we'll be talking to Dr. Quentin Henning, who is also involved with another exciting story, Novo Resources. So don't go away. We'll be right back with Dr. Quentin Henning.
Novo Resources Corp. trades on the OTCQX under the symbol NSRPF and on the TSX Venture Exchange under NVO. Its flagship assets are located in the Karratha region of Western Australia, where they are currently drilling and trenching their Purdy's Reward project. In addition, Novo has partnered with Sumitomo Mining Corporation to advance its Beaton's Creek Gold Project toward production. With over $70 million in cash and strong shareholder support from the likes of Kirkland Lake Gold, Novo is well on its way to establishing itself as one of the top junior explorers and developers in Australia.
StrikePoint Gold, trading under SKP on the TSX and STKXF on the OTC, has a market cap of under $10 million. StrikePoint is a new player in the Golden Triangle of BC and Canada. Focus will be on drilling the Willoughby Project in 2019. Prior drilling delivered over 20 meters of 25 grams per ton gold and 184 grams per ton silver. Recent receding glaciers have identified new gold targets. Neighboring projects have been acquired by StrikePoint's largest shareholder, Ascot. Eric Sprott and Skeena round out the other top shareholders.
Follow us on Twitter at VoiceAmericaTRN. Get the lowdown on guests, new shows, and your favorites. That's VoiceAmericaTRN.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really glad to have with me once again Dr. Quentin Henning of Novo Resources. Welcome, Dr. Henning. Thanks for joining me again.
Thank you, Jay.
You know, I'd like to start out by asking you a little bit about your comment, well, on Purdy's Reward discoveries, because that's where all of the action was in 2017 that drove your share price up to as high as around $8.50 in Canadian money. So perhaps we can start out there. I'd like to find out what you're doing there, if you what your exploration plans are there, since that's where all the excitement started out a couple of years ago.
Certainly, Jay. As you see today, we issued a news release talking about our mineralization report. We have completed that. I had to pass it under, you know, several people's nose to review over the past week or two. But it's finalized now, and it most importantly explains where we can take some large-scale bulk samples and kind of the next steps forward. So I would advise people to read the news release. But in short, here's what we're looking at. the project at Comet Well and Purdy's Reward, very nuggety gold, as everyone knows. But we've tackled this before at Beaton's Creek, you know, about 300 kilometers east of Karratha. We tackled a similar project, not quite as nuggety, but, you know, it was nuggety. It was a challenge for us initially, but we overcame it. And we recently announced a significant resource upgrade, as well as achieving, application for mining at Beaton's Creek. It's been approved. It's actually ready for mining. And our mining lease has been approved as well. So these are kind of seminal steps for us. You know, Karratha, we see a similar path now to what we undertook at Beaton's Creek. We do anticipate doing a large-scale bulk sampling program similar to the one we did at Beaton's Creek a couple of years back. We can see that as providing the technical input that we need to really understand the deposit, understand grades, understand processing techniques, so forth. But it also could help us potentially lead to putting a resource to Karratha, which is very important here. So, mm-hmm. We see a similar path. We've done it before. We're ready to go to the hard yards, and we're very excited. We also have some work going on right now, some mapping that extends the strike of the conglomerates at Purdy's Reward and Comet Well.
Mm-hmm.
We've also found some mineralization and fairly high-grade mineralization in the basement. So the picture is morphing, but it's growing, and we anticipate quite a bit of progress this year. You know, don't forget ore sorting. Ore sorting will be a very important component of the work going forward. We see that as a critical technique that will be of value.
Yeah, that's very exciting, actually. The ore sorting could just be dramatically it could dramatically improve the economics, I should think, there, especially not so much at Beaton's Creek. It's more to do with the larger nuggeting effect up at Comet Well and Purdy's Reward, right?
That's correct. You know, we did our test work late last year, announced some news releases early this year that talk about the success of that ore sorting technique. And it's just astonishing, you know, to see a machine that can actually pick gold particles or pick rocks with gold particles embedded in them out from, a huge amount of waste material. So, you know, we see a great deal of promise. I'd advise people to read the news release that we issued today, because it talks about the potential benefits we could see from ore sorting and how we could implement grade control at Comet Well and Purdy's Reward as well. You know, this is a challenging deposit. How do you define the boundaries of it? Well, if you're putting rock through on a continual basis, you can actually use the computer that's driving the ore sorting process to help you quantify grades, you know, mm-hmm. almost instantaneously. It's kind of a instant feedback type approach, but quite frankly, I don't know of any other deposit, at least gold deposit, that uses a similar approach. They might do it with diamonds, I don't know, but this is very innovative.
Very innovative. I mean, it just stands to reason if a really large, and I don't remember what the sort of percentages were, but the vast quantity of rock was barren, did not have gold in it, but was able to take out a very small percentage of that mass that had gold. And so if you could leave the barren rock behind and just, you know, concentrate the high grade, wow, what an improvement, what a cost reducer that would be. Well, I know go ahead.
I see. That's right. That's correct.
Yeah, you know, you cut your teeth then at Beaton's Creek, and you learned an awful lot about conglomerate gold and how it was. In a way, it was really quite good because it wasn't nearly as nuggety, but quite nuggety at Beaton's Creek, and that really helped prepare you for an even more nuggety project over there at Comet Well and Purdy's Reward. So what might we expect from those two projects? What kind of news might we expect then going forward over the next several months from Beaton's Creek and Karratha?
Sure. At Karratha, what we expect is final plans for bulk sampling, large-scale bulk sampling. The reference that's made in today's news release gives people a sense of what scale we're looking at. You know, it's on the order of 100,000 tons.
We
do have sample sites identified from the mineralization report. And by the way, the mineralization report is not a 43-101 compliant report. We cannot publish that, but we are updating the 43-101 report for Karratha based on the information that's in the mineralization report, and that'll be issued in the not-too-distant future. But it'll show the five recommended areas for bulk sampling, at Caratha. We'll figure out. Right now, believe it or not, it looks like the best way to proceed there is not necessarily go the mining lease application route first. I think we can pull this off by working with the Mirs in Western Australia. See if we can achieve the bulk sampling through another avenue. So that's very positive. We also have to do a little bit of additional work on the ore sorting to get kind of an optimal scenario for ore sorting worked out. What we're doing there is we're looking at how to treat the finer grain material, you know, that when they crush it, there's a fraction of material that's, say, less than 6 or 8 millimeters mm-hmm. in that size range that we're looking at how to treat that material. Mm-hmm. And we have made some headway there. And then at Beaton's Creek, like I said earlier, we've got now our mining application's been fully approved, so it's ready. It's basically dressed up and ready for the dance. We're doing this option study at the moment. We're looking at various scenarios about how to treat Beaton's Creek. And quite frankly, you know, the resource that we announced is nearly twice the size of the resource back in 2015, say, that we announced then. And, it, you know, we see that as a seminal step to building something that's larger scale, more sustainable, you know, over the long term. It's, sure. you know, more of a conventional project, we'll call it. So we're very excited about the advancements we've made there.
Yeah, and I think you still have some exploration potential there at Beaton's Creek.
Correct, yes.
Right. All right, well, though, I'd like to ask you about Egina, because you haven't said anything yet about Egina, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that that might be the target, the one of those three projects that might have the most immediate gratification in terms of maybe cash flow. I don't know. You're going to do some bulk sampling there?
That's correct. Look, we put out a news release updating activities at Egina about a week ago. Like you said, it's low-hanging fruit. I mean, this is an interesting project. It's basically a gravel horizon that sits right at the surface. We've now done some work that indicates it's a fairly flat, continuous sheet of gravel. It's gold-bearing. We hope it's gold-bearing consistently throughout, or at least to a degree that one can mine it. Mm-hmm. All right, so we're doing that work this year. We're preparing. We're doing ground-penetrating radar. We're doing some mapping. We're doing some other, like auger drilling and things like this, to really get to the nitty-gritty about the thickness of the horizon, and then we'll do the bulk sampling in a few weeks and process those samples on a routine basis. And this is free-dig material. Sits right at surface. We're tackling an area that's already actually been disturbed there at the edge of the mining lease. This was an area that the gentleman who owned the property before us did some metal detecting not too long ago. So we have access to a pretty big swath within the existing mining lease. Really what we want to get out of this exercise is establish all the protocols for defining a resource on this nugget of gold, but also, you know, get some sense of how we can mine it and that too. It's an interesting project because it's really exploration combined with an element of, you know, bulk sampling that could ultimately lead to ideas about how we could process it on a commercial basis. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a gravity recovery, very coarse gold. If people want to get a sense of the gold that we're dealing with, I'd advise them to look back at the news release from December of last year where we talk about the grade from the initial bulk sample. You can see the photographs of the gold that was recovered. These are very coarse grain stuff. You know, these are nuggets on the order of 2 millimeters or greater, at least the bulk of the gold is. Very easy to recover. Okay, so it's just got everything working for it in terms of geology. Now, we are on the Aboriginal Reserve in that area. This reserve extends over the edge of the mining lease, but the mining lease, as most people know, we've got that carved out. That's ours. It's a long-term lease with the government. We've got all the exploration ground around it tied up. But we are working with the Aboriginals on how to advance the bigger picture. Okay, mm-hmm. This is really critical because this target isn't just a one little corner. You know, it's not just a postage stamp. Mm-hmm. This thing covers literally, you know, potentially hundreds of square kilometers. Mm-hmm. All right, so we are we're actively engaged with the Aboriginal corporation in that area. And, you know, there's been some movement on that front, which is very interesting. We've got, you know, a sense of what where they're at. You know, we've gotten to know them fairly well, what what needs they have. We also, they changed a law firm recently, which the law firm that they've engaged with is one that we've had some dealings with in the past, so we see that as a positive sign. There's a lot of things working for us there. We do see making headway over the next few weeks or even few months on that front and being able to expand out from the mining lease onto the exploration ground around us. And that's critical. If we show the world that this sheet of gravel contains gold over a broad area, mm-hmm. I think it will really open up people's eyes and they'll realize how important this asset is.
So how soon do you think we might start getting a picture of the consistency or lack thereof of gold mineralization in this deposit?
Sure,
will we know a lot more in the next few months?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is, fortunately, this is a relatively easy deposit to work with, free dig. So we're going to start digging samples on the order of 100 tons each. These are bulk samples. We'll do it on a gridded basis. In other words, we'll have a kind of a systematic approach, and we can process those samples. Most importantly, we can process them through our little IGR 3000 plant that's at Station Peak. So we'll be trucking the samples back there. We'll start feeding them through in a staged approach. They're upgrading the plant right now. They're nearly done with those upgrades. I'd say we'll start digging samples here in a few weeks, maybe a couple weeks, and then start processing them towards the end of June or early July. And that'll give us a good indication, like we should be able to tell the market, yep, there's gold in these samples, on a routine basis. Just the initial area that we're targeting, I would say, 2 or 3 months, we should have most of the samples processed through there. And then if we get access to the ground around it, we can expand the exploration significantly. Touch wood, if we find there is a degree of consistency, then we can probably expand our spacing on samples mm-hmm. and start to be more aggressive with this thing. What I would like by the end of this year is to have not only a picture of how we define a resource on these gravels at edge of the mining lease itself, but I want to show the world that the deposit, like I said earlier, continues out onto the greater terrace and that there's potential for something much, much more vast here.
Well, as I understand it, Quentin, Egina is really a weathered portion of the conglomerate to the west. It extends over to Comet Well and Purdy's Reservoir. Do I have that right?
That's absolutely correct. We actually find pieces of weathered conglomerate in the trenches, in this gravel material. In fact, we found nuggets inside some of those chunks of conglomerate. Mm-hmm. So we know a lot of the gold is coming from the conglomerate itself as it weathered away. The gold was liberated and mixed into these gravels. But interestingly, we've been doing a lot of metal detecting in preparation for our upcoming work, and we've found quite a few, not dominantly, but a significant number of what we call Hackley or angular gold nuggets that are derived from veins in the basement. So we actually see the basement is also kicking off or producing some level of coarse gold. These would be veins that are hosted immediately in the footwall of the gravel horizon.
So it would have been a different origin than the precipitation event that you've been talking about in the conglomerates?
Yes or no. The formation that hosts those veins is called the Malina Group, and it was actually deposited at 2.9 billion years. Oh. Interestingly, there are conglomerates in the Malina Group. Now, we don't have enough information. I can talk too broadly about it, but
yeah.
We do think there is some interesting potential in that formation. So hold tight on that. I think, personally, my gut says a lot of the gold that we see in those little veins or that's coming out of the veins was actually initially a precipitation event because it fits right in the right time horizon, but it was remobilized into the veins, and now what we're seeing is a product, derived from that. But we have some, we'll call it, quasi-academic work that we're doing right now that should give us some answers by the end of this year.
All right. Well, just we're really running out of time here, so I have to ask you, with three projects going on, you've got to be burning through quite a bit of cash, Quentin, and I know that you just recently announced some $20 million or so that you pulled in from warrants being exercised, but how is your treasury right now given all of this activity? It's speeding up a lot in the cooler months of Australia.
Yeah, this is the busy season right now. So the $20 million actually came in over the past couple of years. Okay, a lot of those warrants were exercised, back in even late 2017.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So So we have about 50, I think 51 million or thereabouts right now. We will be spending on the order of $1.5 million to $2 million a month for the next 6 or 7 months, basically till the end of the year. We're in a good position, but we do recognize we want to get to the finish line. So, you know, this is a concern we have that we want to make sure we use our money prudently. I'd also advise people to remember we have an MOU with Sumitomo Corporation to look at various ways of financing things. Mm-hmm. Now, Beaton's Creek is, like I said, ready for the dance.
Yeah.
Edgina could be advanced in theory very quickly if things work out right. You know, Cometwell and Purdy's Reward might take a bit of time, you know, like we did at Beaton's Creek, but they also will come to fruition. You know, it's basically all the horses are on the track. It's a matter of seeing which one hits the finish line first and starts generating cash flow for us.
All right. Well, your share price is around $2 a Canadian right now. It's down like most of them are. Most of the gold shares that I'm following are down right now. Nobody seems to be terribly interested in gold shares. With all this activity going on, it seems like investors are going to have a lot to look forward to this over the next several months. And a lot of drivers here, Quentin.
There are, and we're very excited. I'm heading down again. I just got back from Australia a few days ago. I'm heading straight back down in a couple of days. So we're excited. We're doing lots of work.
Thank you very much, Quentin, for being with us again. It's really an exciting story, and really, really pleased that you spent your time with us to help our listeners understand what's going on down there.
Certainly, Jay. Anytime.
Folks, don't go away, because Dan Oliver is going to be back with us right after the break to talk about the dollar and the problems that he envisions for the dollar, and that should be bullish for gold as well. So don't go away. We'll be right back with Dan Oliver.
A gold rush has begun. Recently, three of the largest gold mining companies announced strategic acquisitions in the Yukon Territories. Ahead of them was a group who had already consolidated the key claims covering the historic Klondike Gold Rush into one company, aptly named Klondike Gold Corp. Led by a team of accomplished geoscientists, the company is steadily advancing exploration to reveal the rich source of all that gold. The hunt for the next major discovery is well underway, and Klondike Gold's shareholders are strategically positioned. Stay ahead of the majors and follow KlondikeGoldCorp.com.
Auron Resources is a copper gold exploration company pursuing the world's next major discoveries. It has seven projects, including two active flagships, Committee Bay in northern Canada and Sombrero in southern Peru. This summer will be one of the most exciting times in Auron's history as the company turns the drill at Sombrero for the first time ever. The project's impressive surface results have identified Sombrero as an analog to one of Peru's biggest mines. Auron is also implementing cutting-edge machine learning technology to unlock its highly prospective gold belt at Committee Bay. Visit AuronResources.com and subscribe to keep up with the company's busy year ahead.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me once again Dan Oliver of Mermican Capital. Thanks for joining me again, Dan.
Well, thanks for having me.
You know, I want to focus on an article you wrote back in January 14th titled Our Currency and Our Problem. Of course, some water has passed under the bridges since then, but that's what I'd like to focus on because I thought it was really fascinating. You start out being somewhat concerned that maybe we're going to experience the same kind of a problem. Well, it wasn't really a problem. It turned out to be very bullish for gold. But the immediate response of gold in 2008-2009, the credit crash, was the gold also got taken down because, of course, when the margin clerk calls, you have to sell what you're able to sell, and people were able to sell gold to pay the clerk, the margin clerk. But this time you're suggesting that maybe it might be a bit different, that you're thinking it might gold may not be hit hard on the down, you know, in any kind of a credit crash this time. Could you explain what your thinking is on that?
Sure. I think the operative word there is might, right? I mean, usually history does repeat itself. And the point I make in the article is that if we look at the dollar system as a system, there's about $0.2 trillion of base money. It's the monetary base, the Federal Reserve liabilities, balancing $90 trillion of debt. So when there's a credit crisis and you run out of dollars to service your debt, you need dollars, because if you don't pay your debt back, you lose your collateral. So mm-hmm. you have this giant short squeeze on dollars, and the dollar goes crazy high, and all their prices fall because, as you say, the margin clerk calls around in dollar terms. You got to sell what you can, not what you want to. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened in 2008. And I always point out, though, as part of that story, if you look at gold in real terms, like you value gold against stocks or against oil or against iron ore or copper or anything real, gold actually went shooting higher. And you know what I do in the gold mining space, I really care about the difference between the input prices, which are determined by base commodities, and gold, the output. So that's actually a good time for gold margins in terms of gold. It's a bad time for gold in terms of dollars. If you have dollar debt, you've got major problems. So that's been the pattern. That wasn't just 2008. That's been the pattern going back for decades. And the point I made in the article is that there are a couple of things that suggest that might not happen. It might, but it might not. And one of the reasons it might not is, first of all, gold going into 2008 was in a parabolic uptrend. So you had all kinds of debt-based investors, people who had taken out dollar loans to buy gold, and they got cleaned out. Gold has not been in a parabolic uptrend, as we all know.
Yeah, for sure.
11 years. So you don't have the same market structure of lots and lots of longs that are levered long gold. In fact, if anything, a lot of the managed money is levered short gold. And so when the margin clerk calls, they got to buy gold. So that's one difference. But the more fundamental major difference to me is, when you look at the dollar as the dollar system, right, one of the things people notice, you know, correctly so, is you look at gold in terms of other currencies, Canadian dollars, Australian dollars, I mean, Turkish lira, basically anything else, it's near its all-time highs or breaking out going higher. So it's really only in dollar terms that it is not doing that. And that's, of course, because the dollar is the global currency to finance debt. I mean, as I was saying before, you've got all this debt in dollar terms, which is why people demand dollars. And so the question is, you know, why is that? And that system got going really in the Bretton Woods era. Before that, it was the pound sterling that was the global standard, and World War II shifted that to the dollar standard. And the reason, there were three reasons why that happened. One was economic. The U.S. was by far the global powerhouse, especially coming out of the World War, where everything else is in ruins. Secondly, we were the largest creditor nation, and so countries that wanted to borrow money to rebuild themselves had to borrow on dollar terms, because we were the only country standing. And then third was military. The U.S. at that point had basically the only military worth anything in the war. I mean, the Soviets and us. And so those are the three pillars, really. And if you think about what has happened to those three pillars over the ensuing decades, what's happened is that in terms of military affairs, the U.S. is no longer completely dominant. You know, the Chinese and the Russians have been developing hypersonic missiles that against which we have no defense. You know, the Obama administration spent 8 years deploying gender neutral bathrooms instead of trying to develop next generation missile technology, military technology. So we really, I mean, there are, you know, think tanks in Washington. The Heritage Foundation had a piece that basically within 5 or 10 years, the U.S. military will lose our advantage in all sorts of different categories of military effectiveness. Now, that doesn't mean that it can invade the U.S. It just means that it's harder for us to project power out in the world the way we've been used to since Bretton Woods, essentially. Secondly, the U.S. has gone from being the biggest creditor nation to the biggest debtor nation. And so we don't have the capital we had back then to order people around. And then thirdly, financially, you know, we're still there in terms of most global debt is still done in dollars, but the euro has been chipping away at that, and China's trying to create a Chinese currency zone where they are. And, you know, foolishly, the U.S. used its power to kick countries out of the SWIFT system, like Iran, which you know, regardless of what Iranian, whether that's good policy vis-a-vis Iran, it sent a signal to Russia and other countries that using dollars is very, very dangerous. And so, again, Russia and China, our two big rivals, have been busy setting up their own financial infrastructure, which then they want to deploy regionally. So we're losing also the financial backing. And so when you look around the world, you see, you know, Argentina's economic policies aren't really all that different from ours. And so why is their currency completely collapsing and ours isn't? And the answer is, again, because of those three pillars I mentioned coming out of Bretton Woods. But to the extent those go away, I think the U.S. winds up in the Argentina position at some point if we could keep going down this path. And so that's the larger reason why in a panic in the past, of course, everyone ran to dollars for those reasons. And to the extent that those reasons are no longer operable, there will be a point, again, I don't know if it's going to be this coming panic or an ensuing one, but there will be a point where the panic takes the dollar down and not up and goes flying higher when this all happens. So that was the point of the paper, just thinking about just more deeply the structure of these of markets and the structure of currency and the fact that, again, I always come back to look at the gold price is really the wrong way to do it. The reason why the market has selected gold as money for the past 4,000 or 5,000 years is because it's so stable. And so really you should be looking at other prices in terms of gold. So the U.S. dollar is very strong right now in terms of gold because of these reasons, and that may not persist.
Well, regardless, whether or not we see the short squeeze on the dollar, the dollar is maintained as a result of this short squeeze, strong dollar because everybody has to sell whatever they bought in dollars to pay back the margin clerk. As you point out in your letter, you say, and I quote, if the dollar's value cannot be maintained by an international short squeeze, the markets will look instead to the Fed's balance sheet, and the story there is dire, end of quote. So I guess what you're saying then is those three pillars, to the extent they break down, that could be the reason that that is different this time, I guess, right?
Well, that's right. So all a bank really is a balance sheet, right? And again, the quintessential example is the Bank of Amsterdam, which opened its doors in 1609. You show up with your gold coins. They give you notes that represent those gold coins. And so there's a one-to-one relationship between the notes and the gold. And so when you wonder, hey, what are my notes worth? You look at the assets of the bank. And the fact is the central bank is really not relevant to the question because economics trump politics at the end of the day. Uh-huh. So all the Fed is a balance sheet. Now, again, for long periods of time, depending on how powerful the politics or the country is, you can have politics override that. And so that's what we've had. We haven't had economic forces shaping the value of the currency for the past 60 years. It's been these political factors, military, financial, and economic. But to the extent that those go away, then what you have left is you say, well, what is a dollar at its essence? What is it? And again, as you know, originally in 1792, the first currency act, it was defined as a certain number of grains of silver. And that was shifted to gold in, I think, 1900. But what is it now today? And what it really is in its essence is a unit of liability of the Federal Reserve. And so you say, okay, that's nice. Well, what are the assets that's backing this liability? And through most of its history, the answer would have been physical gold, commercial invoices, not debt, but invoices, and short-term government debt, 3 months, 6 months, that sort of term. Well, now those assets are mortgage-backed securities, yeah, unknown duration, 30-year government bonds. I think the average maturity is up in the 12, 13-year range. And so you say to yourself, okay, is that valuable? Is the debt of Congress, which has this incredible budget deficit and debt, have any value, especially in a rising interest rate environment? And the answer is going to be no. And so, again, as long as the dollar maintains its value as a political entity, those things don't matter a whole lot. But when the politics, when the power behind those politics start eroding, then all of a sudden, Mark will look at the economics and say, hey, what is the Fed's balance sheet look like? And the answer is it looks pretty bad.
So let's talk about, in your article you stated that the U.S. policymakers might enjoy a strategic advantage by a radical devaluation of the dollar. And so let's help our listeners and me understand those pillars start to fall apart, and so the policymakers might switch their thinking in terms of what's the best way out of this mess.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened in the 70s, right? I mean, the U.S. for a long time ran a strong dollar policy, and politicians from Kennedy and Johnson said, oh, we'll never devalue the dollar. It's a symbol of American strength, and it was true. But the U.S. accumulated so many debts during the 60s and the early 70s under Nixon, that finally the only way to get out of those debts was to devalue the currency. We owed Europe tons of dollars. We didn't have the money. And so we said, hey, we're going to devalue the dollar. and then reestablish it on a death standard instead of a gold standard. And so we have a very similar situation now, where now the debt is, of course, orders of magnitude larger than it was in the 70s, and we can't possibly pay it back. And then also, but the point I make in the article is that other actors now are now piggybacking on the dollar system. So China has a bunch of dollars, and they lend them out to these third world countries like Kenya and Pakistan and places, knowing that they're going to default. And then when they default, they take strategic assets like ports and airports and things, strategic things like that. And so there may come a time where U.S. policymakers think to themselves, you know what, the only way out of this trap we've constructed for ourselves in terms of the amount of debt and in terms of people like China piggybacking on our system is to devalue it. And that would allow third world countries to pay off China in devalued terms. So it would hamper Chinese imperial ambitions for a time. It would also allow the U.S. government to pay back its debt in nominal terms. And you know, of course, Jay, as you know very well, this is always the end result of countries that wind up too much debt. The Romans did this, right? They kept debasing their silver currency until there was nothing left, and that was the only way they could afford to pay the military and the bureaucrats. And so there's nothing new about this policy. The only newness is when do the policymakers wake up to the fact that they are trapped and they have to do something dramatic to keep the show from going forward? And I think the answer will be when the financial markets collapse and they can't fund themselves because tax revenue dries up. They may say to themselves, hey, you know, the only way forward is to start printing the money, like big time, you know, helicopter money.
And very, very possibly. I mean, it seems to me that the Chinese, for sure, and some other countries started to become concerned about the dollar big time after the last financial crisis. And I'm wondering, Dan, I think you would probably agree with this, that in order to have the world's reserve currency, you have to orchestrate chronic deficits so that you're always putting out a massive amount of money floating around a massive amount of your currency floating around the globe so that there's enough liquidity. I mean, one of the excuses that everybody gives why the dollar can never not be reserve currency is that there will be there's just no other currency that can compete in terms of liquidity and so forth. But
That was Minsky's point, right? And I completely disagree with that. I mean, that is the case if your currency is based upon a debt system, right? Because debt compounds exponentially over time, and you need more and more dollars to continue the system from blowing up. If your currency is based on an equity system, i.e. gold, there's plenty of liquidity for gold and gold derivatives. And I don't mean paper gold like in London kind of thing, but right. What I mean is, the physical sitting in a bank and people have claims to the gold and the equity right. claims trade, there's plenty of liquidity. And that gold is much higher priced today to make it happen, which will happen at some point when the system breaks down. But so I disagree that a reserve currency is necessarily has to be based on debt, and therefore you have to increase its quantity exponentially to get this blowing up. That's the system we have, but that's a bad system.
Yeah, that's the system we have. Under this current system, though, you have to keep pumping more currency out there in order to retain. But then the problem, Dan, that I see is we see all the charts show debt is growing exponentially while GDP, if you even believe the numbers, are growing in a linear fashion. So clearly you don't have to be a rocket scientist to understand that system's going to break down sometime. And now it's even growing more rapidly under Trump. He's spending more than every president seems to spend more than the previous president. So a very interesting picture that I don't know, Hugo Salinas Price, he pointed out that over the last, I think it was 6 or 7 years, the U.S. cumulative deficit, trade deficit, increased by over $3.6 trillion, and yet the amount of money that's in the central banks, the amount of dollars that held by central banks, actually declined by about 4%. His theory is that already what's happening is the central bank of China and others perhaps, but China being the dominant one, is buying gold with those dollars and leaving it in the hands perhaps of other Chinese citizens, and then they use that money and go out and buy assets around the world, and that the Chinese may be backing out of the dollar system that way. Does that sound like it could be?
I think the Chinese have gotten a lot of mileage playing the dollar system, so I don't think they're going to be the ones to torpedo it. I do think that they've been buying a lot of gold because they're clever enough to know that its days are numbered, and so that they want to play it both ways. As long as the dollar system keeps going, they'll keep exploiting it for their own purposes, and then when it blows up, they'll have gold in reserve to fall back on, and that's a very sensible policy. I think Russia's doing the exact same thing. So I and also I would point out that don't forget, central banks aren't really the main sources of money creation. The main sources of money creation are the commercial banks, the private banks. They're the ones who lever up assets and do maturity mismatch and have fractured banking, all that business. The function of the Fed is to run in and save them when they blow up. That's their function. So they don't need to print the money as long as the commercial banks are willing to increase leverage, which they are doing. So their role comes later when they get to print the money to backstop them when they blow up, and that's probably not too far off.
Dan, with just a couple of minutes left, with respect to the gold mining industry, which I know you pay a lot of attention to, you made the point in one of your recent missives that at $1,300, most of the mining companies make enough money to pay good salaries and pay their debt, but there's not a whole lot more left over. What do you think we need in the way of a gold price to make the gold mining industry some place that people want to put their capital in again?
Well, I think I opened at 1300. I'm not a chart guy, but it's pretty obvious. Once we cross 1350, 1370, whatever the number is, we're going to go shooting higher. And at that point, what will happen is, and the way markets work is when you don't need the capital, it all comes out of the woodwork.
Yeah.
And so right when gold is at 1400, 1500 and the industry can self-fund itself, then you'll find all the third party guys running it. And that's when you get a big, big spike in valuations. It's been painful waiting for that. It's going to happen. When, I don't know, but it will, because gold always goes up in terms of currencies that the government is running deficits on. So it's just a matter of time.
The last credit crisis, of course, China was there in a big way with massive amounts of stimulus, and that sort of increased commodity prices around the world. It helped to pull us out of the dungeon, so to speak. Meantime, as we just noted, they've been increasing their largest gold producer. They've been importing huge amounts of gold from around the world. Do you think that they may not be there to send us whatever you call that thing they throw out on the water, to save people that are drowning? You think the
Chinese are not altruistic, right? 2008, they looked around the world, everything was super cheap, and their commodities were on the floor, and they had money, so they bought them all. But the problem is their economic model is even crazier than ours is, right? They spent the last 20 years building ghost cities and full-scale replicas of Paris and New York and all that crazy things. Everyone owns four apartments, they live in one of them. So I don't think China's going to be there, because I think they're on the verge of blowing up as well. Some of their banks are rolling over finally, the economies are letting some of these companies blow up the first time. So I the chances that the Chinese can muster another credit response to bail the world out, I think it's very, very slim.
30 seconds left. What should we be looking for in terms of Fed policy to figure out which way this might go?
Well, I think before we started, if you look at the yield curve, it's just going negative again. And it does that usually right before there's a big financial crisis. And because financial dislocation is bigger than ever, I think the crisis is bigger than ever. So I think what you want to look for is, when do the markets force the Fed to react and start printing the money again, and how do they do it? And I think the markets are betting it happens before the end of the year. And that's got to be good for gold prices, I think. So, I mean, I'm hoping this funk we're in doesn't last too much longer.
Good for gold prices. I'm not sure how good it is for our national discourse, but that's another issue for another time. Dan, thanks so much for being with us today and helping us understand the really crazy world that we're living in. It's great to have you, as always.
Thanks.
All right, folks. Well, that is all the time we have for this week. Next week, Richard Mayberry is scheduled to be my guest, and Ivan Bebek of RN Resources as well. And I think Michael Oliver will probably join me again. So until next week, goodbye, and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.